Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. Did you know you can get Democracy Now!'s headlines and stories delivered directly to your inbox every day? Just text Democracy Now!, one word, no space. Text Democracy Now! To 66866 to subscribe to our daily digest, and you'll never miss a story. Once again, Democracy Now!, one word, to 66866. Thanks so much, and stay safe. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
These interviews and pieces of evidence reveal a deeply disturbing yet clear picture. Governor Cuomo sexually harassed current and former state employees in violation of both federal and state laws.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo sexually harassed at least 11 women, touching and kissing them without consent. This according to a damning investigation by New York Attorney General Letitia James. Cuomo defended himself against the allegations with a video message. His longtime ally, President Biden, and the entire Democratic congressional delegation of New York are now calling on him to resign, and the New York State Assembly plans to draft articles of impeachment. We'll speak with State Senator Julia Salazar and Xochitl Numica, director of the New York Working Families Party. Then we go to Minnesota, where at least 20 water protectors were brutally arrested as resistance to the Enbridge Line 3 pipeline continues.
I stand with young people and all people who are fighting for this world and fighting for life. There's nothing more powerful than fighting for life. A lot more of us need to act and need to do it soon.
We'll speak with indigenous lawyer Tara Hauska, who published photos of herself on social media with bloodied welts on her arms after she was shot with rubber bullets by police. But first, the Biden administration partially reinstates the eviction moratorium after massive public outcry. And we'll look at how critics say Biden's bipartisan infrastructure bill fails to urgently address the climate emergency, and why some say progressives in Congress should block it. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Biden administration's issued a new two-month moratorium on evictions covering much of the country after facing intense pressure from progressive lawmakers led by Congressmember Cori Bush. The new CDC moratorium will cover areas of the United States where there's substantial or high spread of the coronavirus. A nationwide moratorium on evictions expired Saturday after Democratic lawmakers failed to pass a bill to protect millions of people who could be forced from their homes. On Friday night, Democratic Congressmember Cori Bush, who was once unhoused herself, began camping out on the steps of the Capitol in protest. She stayed on the steps until Tuesday's announcement. In a tweet, Bush wrote, "On Friday night, I came to the Capitol with my chair. I refused to accept that Congress could leave for vacation while 11 million people faced eviction. For 5 days, we've been out here demanding that our government acts to save lives. Today, our movement moved mountains," she said. During an interview on CNN, Bush responded to the temporary moratorium extension.
Elated and I'm overwhelmed, you know, because just the thought that so many people right now, millions of people, you know, will not be forced out on the streets.
Meanwhile, Democratic Congressmember Rashida Tlaib is calling on House Democrats to return recent contributions from real estate tycoon George Marcus, who recently donated $1 million to the House Majority PAC just weeks before Democratic lawmakers failed to extend the eviction moratorium. The COVID-19 death toll in Indonesia has topped 100,000 after authorities reported 1,700 new deaths today. Indonesia's death toll has doubled since May. Meanwhile, in Japan, Tokyo has set yet another record for COVID cases, reporting over 4,100 new infections today in the Olympics host city. Here in the United States, Florida Republican Governor Ron DeSantis is rejecting calls to impose a mask mandate as the state set a new record with over 11,500 hospitalized COVID patients. Doctors say 95% of the patients are unvaccinated. Louisiana has reinstated an indoor mask mandate as its hospitals also struggle to treat a record number of COVID patients. The American Academy of Pediatrics reports 72,000 children in the United States tested positive for COVID last week, an 85% increase over the previous week. The Academy estimates less than 2% of children infected require hospitalization. Here in New York City, Mayor Bill de Blasio has announced the city will soon require proof of vaccination to dine indoors, go to the gym, or attend indoor entertainment events. In other COVID news, the New York Times reports the Food and Drug Administration is moving towards fully approving the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine by September. Meanwhile, former President Barack Obama has announced plans to significantly scale down his 60th birthday bash this weekend at the family's $12 million estate in Martha's Vineyard due to the spread of the Delta variant. President Biden and the entire Democratic congressional delegation of New York is calling on New York Governor Andrew Cuomo to resign after an independent investigation concluded Cuomo had violated state and federal law by sexually harassing 11 women, including 9 current or former government employees. On Tuesday, New York State Attorney General Letitia James released her 165-page report after conducting a 5-month probe.
The independent investigation found that Governor Cuomo sexually harassed multiple women, many of whom were young women, by engaging in unwanted groping, kisses, hugging, and by making inappropriate comments.
On Tuesday, Governor Cuomo defended himself against the allegations and rejected calls to resign. Members of the New York State Assembly are now moving ahead with plans to draft articles of impeachment. The governors of New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, and Rhode Island also issued a joint statement calling for Cuomo to resign. We'll have more on this story after headlines. In election news, Chantel Brown has defeated Nina Turner, Bernie Sanders' former campaign co-chair, in a closely watched special Democratic primary to fill the seat of Marsha Fudge in Ohio's 11th congressional district. Brown is the chair of the Cuyahoga County Democratic Party. She'd received the backing of many establishment Democrats, including Hillary Clinton and Congressmember James Clyburn, as well as the Democratic majority for Israel PAC, which spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on the race. Nina Turner was endorsed by Senator Sanders, Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and other progressives. In a statement Tuesday night, Turner said, quote, "We didn't lose this race. The evil money manipulated and maligned this election." In Ohio's 15th congressional district, the Trump-backed coal lobbyist Mike Carey won the Republican primary, defeating 10 others. In Afghanistan, at least 8 people died Tuesday when a car bomb exploded in a heavily secured area of Kabul outside the villa of Afghanistan's defense minister, who was not home at the time. The BBC reports it was the first major bombing in Kabul in over a year. It comes as Taliban fighters are attempting to seize 3 provincial capitals, Kandahar, Herat, and Lashkargah. The United Nations reports at least 40 civilians have been killed in Lashkargah and 118 wounded over the past day. According to the Associated Press, the Taliban now controls 9 of the 10 districts in Lashkargah, despite repeated U.S. airstrikes to slow their advance. The Afghan army has urged civilians to leave the city before the army launches a major counterattack against the Taliban. Meanwhile, Human Rights Watch has accused the Taliban of summarily executing soldiers, police, and civilians who've been detained during its recent offensive ahead of the U.S. military withdrawal, which is scheduled to conclude by the end of August. In Greece, thousands of people have fled their homes as wildfires rage uncontrollably in the northern suburbs of Athens amidst Greece's worst heat wave in decades. Greek firefighters are battling 81 forest fires across the country as temperatures soar to 116 degrees Fahrenheit. Meanwhile, more than 16,000 people have been evacuated in Turkey, which has been struggling to contain scores of fires over the past week. Police in Ukraine have opened a murder investigation after a Belarusian activist was found dead near his home in Kiev. Vitaly Shishov's body was found Tuesday hanging from a tree in a park. Shishov was a vocal critic of the Belarusian president, Alexander Lukashenko, and helped provide refugee to Belarusians who fled the city. The country. Lebanon is marking 1 year since the devastating explosion at the port of Beirut killed 218 people, injured 7,000, and destroyed or damaged 300,000 homes. Lebanon is now facing its worst economic crisis in history. Meanwhile, no one in the political leadership has been held accountable for leaving over 2,700 tons of highly explosive ammonium nitrate fertilizer unattended at Beirut's port. A new report by Human Rights Watch implicates senior Lebanese officials for failing to protect the public.
Culpability for the explosion still rests with those officials who knew the ammonium nitrate was being stored at the port in an unconscionable and dangerous manner and failed to do what was within their authority and under their responsibility to secure or remove it.
Ibrahim Raisi has officially become Iran's new president. He's a conservative cleric and protege of Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei. On Tuesday, he vowed to fight U.S. sanctions.
We will definitely pursue the lifting of tyrannical sanctions, but we will definitely not allow people's financial ability and the economy to be impacted by it. We will not link the sanctions to outsiders' wishes.
In Texas, a federal judge has temporarily blocked Republican Governor Greg Abbott from carrying out an executive order that restricted asylum seekers to traveling only with law enforcement officials and directed state troopers to stop vehicles suspected of transporting migrants. Immigrant justice organizations and others have often helped transport asylum seekers who are released from custody to their final destination. Abbott's executive order is blocked until next week when another hearing is scheduled. And Missouri's Republican Governor Mike Parson has pardoned the wealthy white St. Louis couple who brandished guns at peaceful Black Lives Matter protesters who marched by their mansion last year. Mark and Patricia McCloskey were originally charged with felonies, but later pleaded guilty to misdemeanor charges. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo sexually harassed at least 11 women, including touching and kissing them without consent and making inappropriate remarks. Those are the findings of a five-month investigation led by the office of New York Attorney General Letitia James, who announced the results of the probe on Tuesday.
These interviews and pieces of evidence reveal a deeply disturbing yet clear picture. Governor Cuomo sexually harassed current and former state employees in violation of both federal and state laws. The independent investigation found that Governor Cuomo sexually harassed multiple women, many of whom were young women, by engaging in unwanted groping, kisses, hugging, and by making inappropriate comments. Further, the governor and his senior team took actions to retaliate against at least one former employee for coming forward with her story, her truth. And Governor Cuomo's administration fostered a toxic workplace that enabled harassment and created a hostile work environment where staffers did not feel comfortable coming forward with complaints about sexual harassment due to a climate of fear and given the power dynamics.
Hours after the report's findings were announced, Governor Cuomo defended himself against the allegations. He rejected calls to resign, saying his habits were part of the way he was raised. As he spoke, pictures on the screen showed him embracing people.
I do it with everyone, black and white, young and old, straight and LGBTQ, powerful people, friends, strangers, people who I meet on the street.
One of the 11 women accusing Cuomo of sexual misconduct, his former aide, Charlotte Bennett, demanded his resignation Tuesday. In an interview on CBS News with Norah O'Donnell, Bennett was asked about Cuomo saying in a statement he'd asked Bennett questions he doesn't normally ask people because she's a survivor of sexual assault.
I think he still thinks that victim blaming is an effective means to negate the facts, but I think it's just more embarrassing for him than it is actually effective.
The governor admitted that he asked you questions that he doesn't normally ask people because you told him you're a survivor of sexual assault. Do you think he's gaslighting you?
Absolutely.
The entire New York Democratic congressional delegation is now calling on Cuomo to resign, as well as President Biden, who was asked about his longtime political ally on Tuesday.
Are you now calling on him to resign?
Yes.
And if he doesn't resign, do you believe he should be impeached and removed from office?
Let's take one thing at a time here. I think he should resign.
Members of the New York State Assembly are moving ahead with plans to draft articles of impeachment. This probe was civil, not criminal. But the district attorney in Albany has requested the materials from the report and encouraged other survivors to come forward. For more, we're joined by two guests. Julia Salazar is New York State Senator for the 18th District, and Soce Numica is director of the New York Working Families Party. They co-wrote a piece for Jacobin earlier this year headlined, Andrew Cuomo's reign is over, now it's the left's turn. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! So much has happened in the last 24 hours with the release of this report. Again, it is civil, not criminal, but now the Albany prosecutor is looking into possibly bringing criminal charges. You're State Senator Julia Salazar. Can you talk about what's happening in this legislative body? An impeachment would happen in the Assembly. And what's different about, for example, the impeachment of Clinton or the impeachment of Trump, that in according to New York state law, Cuomo would have to step aside during the trial and lieutenant governor would become the governor. But talk about all of the charges and your reaction to the report.
Yeah, so several months ago, the Office of the State Attorney General, Letitia James, began the investigation, which concluded with the report that her office issued yesterday. But concurrent with the Attorney General's investigation has been the investigation in the State Assembly that was also initiated in the spring, an impeachment investigation in order to ultimately produce articles of impeachment, which have not been drafted yet. But the State Assembly is looking at not only the sexual harassment allegations against Governor Cuomo, which have been substantiated in the Attorney General's report, but additionally, the investigation is focused on the governor's office concealing the deaths of many New Yorkers in nursing homes due to COVID-19, in part as a result of an order that was issued by the Department of Health in 2020 during the peak of the pandemic. They're also looking at the governor's potential misuse of public funds, of state funds, in service of his $5 million book deal, which he secured in the peak of the pandemic as well. They are looking at additional allegations against the governor, and any one of these alone would potentially be grounds for impeachment, including any one of the 11-plus allegations, sexual harassment allegations that have been substantiated. But it really doesn't look good for Governor Cuomo. When the Assembly drafts articles of impeachment and votes, a simple majority is needed in the Assembly in order for the impeachment process to move on to the Senate, in which case there would be a high court of impeachment, which includes all sitting senators except for the Senate Majority Leader, due to the Senate Majority Leader being second in line of succession. And the seven judges on the state's highest court, the Court of Appeals, and that would make up the impeachment court, which would need a two-thirds majority in order to impeach Governor Cuomo and remove him from office.
And Senator Salazar, what is your personal reaction to the report, especially the findings of the toxic work environment that the governor had in his office, which for many politicians, there was a toxic environment throughout state government as a result of Andrew Cuomo's methods of operation. And you personally have witnessed some of that. Could you talk about that?
The report is devastating and it is disturbing. And unfortunately, it's not surprising to anyone who has spent time in Albany. The governor has threatened people. There are numerous reports about this. He has threatened members of the press. He has threatened legislators. I personally, as a state legislator, have always sought to avoid direct interactions with the governor out of fear. A lot of legislators are in constant fear of retaliation by the governor if they speak out against his political agenda or speak out about his behavior. And so, unfortunately, this is unsurprising to those of us in Albany. And there were many of us as early as February and March who have been calling for the governor to be impeached and for him to resign, which are not mutually exclusive, of course. We still are demanding that the governor resign and that we move forward with an impeachment trial.
I wanted to ask Soshi Namaka of the Working Families Party. The Assembly obviously has to take up articles of impeachment, but Carl Hastie, the Speaker of the Assembly, has not exactly been a profile in courage in the past. What's your expectation to how this will unfold in the Assembly?
Thank you, Juan. I think what we've heard and what we've seen from Assembly leaders across political stripes, up and down different geographic corridors of New York State, is that Assembly members are saying with one voice, we must proceed with impeachment. And so Speaker Hastie is someone who does really listen to and look to his members. That unequivocal and clear demand must be heard and met. As Senator Salazar said, Governor Cuomo resigning, being called to resign, does not negate the responsibility that the Assembly has to take forward this charge of impeachment. The list of violations that the governor has undertaken over the past 2 years is a stain on New York's history. We have to move forward, and the Assembly must hold on to the power that they have and move forward to remove the governor from office as swiftly as possible.
I wanted to comment on the front page of The Times. It has a banner headline, Cuomo urged to quit after damaging report. And then it quotes the women in their own words, some of those 11 women from the 165-page report that was issued by Letitia James, the attorney general. But the report was carried out by two very well-respected prosecutors, particularly well-versed in issues of sexual assault and sexual abuse. It starts with executive assistant number one. I knew I could feel him pushing my body against his and death. definitely making sure he could feel my breasts up against his body and was doing it in a way that I felt was obviously uncomfortable for me. And he was maybe trying to get some sort of personal satisfaction from it. Trooper number one, and this is particularly significant, his security detail, a woman on a security detail saying, I remember just freezing, being in the back of my head. I'm like, oh, how do I say no politely? Because in my head, if I said no, he's going to take it out on the detail. And now I'm on the bad list. She went on to talk about how he had touched her from her chest down to her private parts. He would run his hand along her body. And then there's Charlotte Bennett, the former top aide to Mr. Cuomo, saying the way he was repeating, you were raped and abused and attacked and assaulted and betrayed over and over again while looking at me directly in the eyes was something out of a horror movie. It was like he was testing me. And then Lindsay Boylan, who is the former state economic development official, who said, I've been sexually harassed throughout my career, but not in a way where the whole environment was set up to feed the predator. And this in every interaction I had with the governor and the culture felt like it was all to feed the predator. Let me go to Charlotte Bennett, who I quoted before, who told CBS News anchor Norah O'Donnell that the governor repeatedly made inappropriate comments during colluding questions about her experience as a sexual assault survivor.
He asked me if age difference mattered. He also explained that he was fine with anyone over 22.
And how old are you?
25.
What were you thinking as he's asking you these questions?
I thought he's trying to sleep with me. The governor's trying to sleep with me. And I'm deeply uncomfortable. And I have to get out of this room as soon as possible.
That interview conducted in March. Julia Salazar, the overall climate and what was known in the legislature. I mean, this kind of open secret, because the point of several of the women was that it wasn't just him. It was what they all made possible and the repercussions against them. You yourself, a sexual assault survivor. In your case, it was quite public. And you accused the spokesperson for the former Israeli prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. He ultimately was forced to resign.
Yes, it's really disturbing as a sexual assault survivor to witness this play out. And additionally, as a legislator, we're familiar with the culture of fear that Governor Cuomo has created in Albany. Charlotte is absolutely right and very courageous in speaking out about her own experience. The culture that Governor Cuomo has created protects him, and it just perpetuates this cycle. People are fearful of him, are fearful of being retaliated against, and it also creates a culture in which people are loyal to him and are complicit in perpetuating this behavior and covering it up. I know, you know, in my own experience, I was essentially coerced into publicly speaking about being sexually assaulted when it was during my state Senate campaign in 2018, when a hostile reporter from the Daily Mail contacted me and said that they knew about it and they were going to publish it. And I then was forced to speak about it publicly. And thankfully, several other women within an hour of me having to speak about being sexually assaulted by the spokesperson for the Israeli prime minister, they came forward and they said, this man is a sexual predator. We've had our own experiences with him. And it wasn't long after that, a matter of months before he was forced to resign. But I really, as someone who had not originally planned at the time to ever speak publicly about what had happened to me, I really admire the people, the workers, the women like Charlotte, who had the courage to speak out on their own volition so that other women would be empowered to do so as well.
And I'd like to ask Soshi Nemeka about this whole issue of the role of the media in propping up and making Andrew Cuomo sort of a national hero during the COVID pandemic, the worst days of the COVID pandemic, the tendency of the media, for instance, to portray his battles with Bill de Blasio as two competing egos. What responsibility do the media have for all of these years, basically not really delving into the autocratic nature of Governor Cuomo?
You know, it's really been a series of disappointing revelations. Obviously, during the darkest moments of the pandemic, Americans were desperate for a counterforce to President Trump's blustering incompetence. And Governor Cuomo presented himself as a, you know, Prince Charming, and the media and Americans and so many of us ate it up. But this is also recognizing years and years of a governor who led through fear and through austerity and through exclusion and through bullying. This, the way that they put forward those things as leadership, signs of leadership, his team often speaks to his bullying ways, his yelling, his diminishing comments as signs of leadership. But what is clear now is that they're actually the other side of an abuser's coin. What he does on the outside to exclude, to shame, to silence his opponents, what we see is that behind closed doors and in the shadows, he uses those very same leadership traits to abuse, to prey on, and to sexually harass. Those are components of his leadership quality, and we cannot extol them in public when we see the very real ways in which his bravado is actually abuse.
And what would it mean if he was forced, if he either resigns or forced step down? Can you talk a little about Sochi, Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul?
Well, we need to usher in a post-Cuomo moment. We need a full transformation of New York State. And that's both in terms of policies, right? Governor Cuomo and his administration has overseen the largest housing crisis, overdose crisis, in the New York's history. We have failed to fully fund education until this year when progressives took over the budget. So it's both the policies that very much affect working people's lives, which have to happen under a new governor with progressive aims, but it's also the style of governing. There's a whole new bench of leadership represented by people like State Senators Julia Salazar, who know that we have to govern in a different way. We've seen a parade of New York leaders leave in disgrace, whether it's corruption or harassment or other unethical dealings. We need a new page, a brand new page in the state, and that will start with a progressive governor. Kathy Hochul did step out and condemn the governor's behavior yesterday, after many, many months of us knowing that the governor was guilty of the very, very clear facts are put on the table. And so I think we need a new page in New York history that will start with a new governor that's committed to progressive ideals that will put New Yorkers first and will not build a government of fear and protectionism to really just prop up their own political career.
Sochi Nemeka, I want to thank you for being with us, director of the New York Working Families Party, and Julia Salazar, who is a New York State Senator, 18th District. We'll link to your piece in Jacobin that you wrote earlier this year, Andrew Cuomo's reign is over, now it's the left's turn. Next up, we look at how President Biden has partially reinstated the eviction moratorium after mass protests, and we'll look at the infrastructure bill, why some are saying progressives in Congress should block Biden's bill. Stay with us. Am I high?
Yeah. Am I high? Look around, all you see is me up in the streets. Look around, all you see is me up in the streets. Look around, all you see is me up in the streets. Look around, all you see is me up in the streets.
Jenny Fisher. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Biden administration's issued a new two-month moratorium on evictions covering much of the country after facing massive public outcry from progressive lawmakers led by Congressmember Cori Bush. The new CDC moratorium will cover areas of the United States where there's substantial or high spread of the coronavirus. A nationwide moratorium on evictions expired Saturday after Democratic lawmakers failed to pass a bill to protect millions of people could be forced from their homes. On Friday night, Democratic Congressmember Cori Bush, who was once unhoused herself, began camping out with others on the steps of the Capitol in protest, staying until Tuesday's announcement. In a tweet, Bush wrote, "On Friday night, I came to the Capitol with my chair. I refused to accept Congress could leave for vacation while 11 million people faced eviction. For 5 days, we've been out here demanding that our government acts to save lives. Today, our movement moved mountains." During an interview on CNN, Bush responded to the temporary moratorium extension.
"I'm elated and I'm overwhelmed, you know, because just the thought that so many people right now, millions of people, you know, will not be forced out on the streets."
Meanwhile, Democratic Congressmember Rashida Tlaib is calling on House Democrats to return recent contributions from real estate tycoon George Marcus, who recently donated $1 million to the House Majority PAC just weeks before Democratic lawmakers failed to extend the eviction moratorium. For more, we're joined by Branko Marcetic, staff writer at Jacobin Magazine, where his latest piece is headlined, "The Democrats' Eviction Moratorium Failure is Unforgivable." You wrote the piece before the announcement Tuesday. In a minute, we'll talk to you about the infrastructure deal, but the significance of the now eviction moratorium that's more targeted, but also the popular outcry led by Cori Bush once unhoused herself.
Yeah, I think it's a really important lesson. Obviously, there's a lot of pressure being put on the White House from congresspeople and the like, Pelosi and Maxine Waters apparently were calling the White House over the weekend, basically saying, "Hey, you need to do something about this." So there is an element of, you know, some of that kind of more congenial work going behind the scenes. But I think it's really important also that the failure to actually do anything about the eviction moratorium, which the deadline was known about for a month at the very least. The Supreme Court basically said it would strike it down at the end of June. The failure to do anything about that caused such a big outcry and really fierce criticism among progressives and just ordinary people that I think that was also the other thing that helped push the White House to ultimately, despite saying we don't have the power to do anything and you know, we don't want to risk a broader Supreme Court strike down by issuing another moratorium order, it pushed them to do it. And I think that's a really important lesson. We saw it also with the administration's walk back on the refugee numbers. That announcement when Biden said he was going to keep the refugee numbers basically at Trump's level, incredibly low level, the outcry forced him to backtrack. So I think the lesson here is people need to be willing to criticize this administration. People want the administration to succeed. But sort of treating them with kid gloves is not necessarily going to be the best way to get these kinds of progressive and just outcomes in policy.
But Branko, I wanted to ask you, the criticisms of the administration clearly were needed. But I'm wondering, there were billions of dollars allocated in the previous COVID-19 bills for rental assistance, and most of this money has not yet been given out by the states. New York State has 160,000 people who have applied for rental assistance, and according to the New York Times, almost no one has gotten any money from a Democratic, supposedly liberal state. What's going on with the states giving out the money that's already been apportioned to help tenants?
Well, look, I mean, real estate interests are powerful everywhere. It's not just at a national level. It's also at the state and local levels, perhaps even more so than at the national level. I mean, the other thing is that this was really enabled by the way that this rental assistance was designed. It was designed to delegate to the states, which, you know, I mean, through history, through American history, one of the lessons is that it, when you delegate programs to states to design and implement, it doesn't necessarily always mean that it's going to be a failure or that it's going to be delayed or have problems. But just by nature of the fact that that state governments are not always controlled by you know, progressive lawmakers, it does mean that you risk all these different states and localities putting in different rules and different requirements that end up making it a lot harder for people to get the money. And that's basically what happened. The reason people aren't getting it quickly enough, people are having trouble with you know, being able to apply for these things, being able to, you know, fill out whatever they have to fill out, you know, and you compare it to, say, the PPP support that was given to businesses by the Trump administration. That program was designed, it was a federal program. There was very minimal bureaucracy. It was meant to get money through the door as quickly as possible. And so I think that's a pretty key comparison there, where it shows you this idea, well, you know, if it's business, well, then money has to go as quickly as possible. And you know what, if some people cheat the system or people who are not worthy of this support end up trying to apply for it, then so be it. Whereas when it comes to renters, when it comes to ordinary working people, there's more suspicion. And so I think there's that antiquated mindset. There's still a long way to go to overcome it.
So I want to ask you, Branko, about a key part of President Joe Biden's agenda, the bipartisan bill. That's the first phase of his infrastructure plan. This week, the Senate is working on amendments to the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, which calls for spending $555 billion in new money over 5 years on the country's roads, bridges, water systems, and broadband and the electric grid. But critics say the bill fails to urgently address the climate emergency. The Intercept reports it actually includes $25 billion in potential new subsidies for fossil fuels. The outcome of the bipartisan bill will set the stage for debate on Biden's much larger $3.5 trillion package, which Republicans strongly oppose but would require a simple majority for passage through reconciliation. So you wrote a piece, Branko Marcetic, in Jacobin magazine, headlined, "Biden's infrastructure deal is terrible. Progressives in Congress should block it." And you also are the author of the biography of Biden, Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. But can you talk about the infrastructure bills as they stand now, and particularly the bipartisan one? What's been stripped out of it?
As you say, a lot of the climate stuff, I mean, the bipartisan bill, by virtue of having to negotiate with Republicans, who, of course, are climate deniers and you know, captured by corporate interests, including fossil fuels. Of course, they do not want a whole host of climate measures in there that are going to compete with those industries or that will, you know, eventually phase them out. So a lot of that stuff has been stripped down. You know, the Clean Energy Standard, which was meant to be one of the cornerstones of transitioning the United States electricity grid away from fossil fuels into renewable energy, that's out of the bill. The spending that was initially put in, you know, the original proposal by Biden was to spend about $125 billion a year. That has gone out. There's still things in there, don't get me wrong. There's, I think, about $66 billion for passenger rail. There's investments in renewable energy and that kind of thing. So it's not nothing, but the numbers are substantially smaller than they were in the original proposal. And the issue there is, you know, overcoming climate change requires a mind-boggling transformation of not just the energy system, but really the way that we live our lives, the way that we structure society. It requires a really, really massive investment of money to do this. Some groups, say the Roosevelt Institute, for instance, they estimate that you need about $1 trillion a year for the next 10 years, at the very least, to be able to do this. You know, you've also got people who talk about the climate crisis and overcoming it as kind of a World War II style effort. Well, In 1945, the amount of the percentage of GDP that was spent for the war effort was about 37.5%. That original climate infrastructure bill was going to spend 1% of GDP per year. So that's the one that was more ambitious. This one is far, far, far less than that. So I think the climate issue is probably the biggest thing that's not in there. But you've also got a whole host of things that are in the $3.5 trillion one that the Senate is trying to pass that are not in this bipartisan bill because I guess they were not considered by Republicans and some of the more conservative Democrats who are negotiating this bipartisan bill as infrastructure. So that includes universal pre-K. That includes free community college. And you know, other things like that, things that are not physical infrastructure. They're not bridges and roads, but they are key to how the economy functions. You need educated workers to be able to have a good functioning economy. You need your people's kids to be taken care of, to have somewhere to go so that people can go to work and not have to think about what they're going to do in terms of childcare. So all of those things are missing from the bipartisan bill. So, you know, if that is the only thing that gets passed, given the slim majorities, given the what's on the horizon in 2022, it's going to be very difficult for Democrats to actually hold the House and the Senate. If this doesn't get passed, it will be looked at as a massive missed opportunity that we will really regret, I think, in years to come.
But then in terms of being able to accomplish both the bigger bill through budget reconciliation and this infrastructure package, how do you foresee that actually happening? And what is the role of progressives in that situation? For instance, if the progressives do try to block infrastructure, and do you think they will have sufficient leverage to get what they want in the reconciliation bill?
Well, yeah, it's tricky. So Biden has said that they're going to pass both bills in tandem. The Senate leadership and other Democratic leadership, they've said as much as well. At the moment, the idea is to pass first the bipartisan bill in the Senate, send it to the House, and then after that, just before the Senate goes in recess, to pass basically the framework for the bigger $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill, which also will then go to the House. Now, the issue is, can progressives trust that if they vote for this bipartisan bill, that they won't have the rug pulled out under them, either by the Biden administration, which has already dropped a number of pretty significant campaign promises, including the public option, which never gets talked about anymore, and by conservative lawmakers, people like Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, who has already said $3.5 trillion, that's way too much money for me, I'm not going to support that. Can they trust that? I would say they cannot. And so the question here is, are progressives, you know, there's a very slim majority in the House that the Democrats have because of the election loss in the House during 2020, which on the one hand was bad for Democrats, but can be very good for, you know, given the fact that there is a pretty substantial number of socialist and progressive lawmakers now in there, who can serve a role like the Tea Party served for the Republicans, you know, back during the Obama years, where they can use their numbers to say, hey, well, if you're not going to give us what we've asked for, then we're going to vote this down. We're going to vote down your bipartisan infrastructure package, and therefore no one gets anything. They have said as much. You know, AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she has said that she will not be voting for the bipartisan package unless the reconciliation bill also goes through. Bernie Sanders in the Senate, he has said the same thing, essentially. The question is, you know, what kind of guarantee are they going to get that they are not going to have that rug pulled under them? You know, and I think a verbal agreement or a verbal assurance is not enough. So, yeah, I would say, look, if the cost of passing the reconciliation bill is having to pass this bipartisan bill as well, that seems like an acceptable price. But if that reconciliation bill looks like it's actually going to get blocked, then progressives need to, you know, use their numbers and use their leverage and wield power that they really have in this Congress.
Branko Marcetic, I want to thank you for being with us. Staff writer at Jacobin Magazine. We'll link to your latest piece, Biden's infrastructure deal is terrible. Progressives in Congress should block it. Next up, we move from the battle in Congress to the battle on the front lines. 20 more water protectors were brutally arrested over the weekend fighting the Enbridge Line 3 pipeline. We'll speak with indigenous lawyer Tara Hauska. Stay with us. Damaged Lemons by Blonde Redhead. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show in Minnesota, where at least 20 water protectors were brutally arrested over the weekend as resistance to the Enbridge Line 3 pipeline continues. Water protectors say state and local police have escalated their use of excessive force using tear gas, rubber, and pepper bullets to repress Line 3 protesters. On Sunday, Indigenous lawyer and activist Tara Hauska published photos of herself on social media with bloodied welts on her arms after she was shot with rubber bullets during an action last week. Hauska and 19 others were held in Pennington County Jail over the weekend, where several water protectors say they were denied medical care for their injuries, were denied proper food, and some were reportedly held in solitary confinement. Well, Tara Hauska joins us now for more from the Namoag camp in Minnesota, founder of the Ginu Collective, and is Ojibwe from Kuchiching First Nation. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Tara. Can you describe what happened when you were arrested and the escalation of force that the police are using against you?
Good morning. So in a situation in which there were a number of shutdowns of various drilling operations across several rivers here in northern Minnesota, this would have been the fifth drill shutdown in as many days. And the attempt by water protectors, including myself, to engage in those processes and attempt to protect the river was met with extreme force. We were under smoky skies and a red sun due to the wildfires that are raging in Ontario, just north of us and west of us, and next to a drought-stricken river. So a very, very deeply harmed river in a gigantic drill in the background, drilling through, attempting to put in a tar sands pipeline through that drought-stricken river. And the level of brutality that was unleashed on us was very extreme. People were shot in their faces, in their bodies, in their upper torsos. I saw a young woman's head get split open right in front of me. It was a really, really brutal scene. And the arrests in person were also quite brutal. Throwing people face down in the dirt and being extremely violent in a situation in which we were outnumbered by police, at least 2-1, and many, many, many counties present protecting this one place, in which also happens to be a county where a murderer, an actual murderer, is still on the loose, has not been caught, but there were somehow over 50 police officers in that one place watching water protectors.
And Tara, could you talk about this increasing cooperation and partnership between Minnesota State and local police and Enbridge?
When I was sitting on the side of a police vehicle with several others waiting to be brought to jail, I overheard several of the police officers talking about how they were going to get bonus time for this brutality they had unleashed upon us. It's, at this point, a pretty known thing that police officers are reimbursed for any costs associated with Enbridge Line 3 protests, and it seems like they welcome the opportunity. One police officer was actually grinning and smiling and said he had a great time and couldn't wait for us to come again. They've billed over $1.7 million to the Public Safety Escrow Trust, in which Enbridge is dumping millions of dollars to incentivize and encourage police officers to repress, suppress, and surveil, harass Indigenous people and our allies that are helping us try to stop this pipeline from happening in our treaty territory. It is a very clear pattern of aggression and of cooperation that's also being enabled by things like the Energy Security Act that has just passed through the House very recently. So it's a precedent that is very dangerous, and everyone should be afraid of this, regardless of whether or not they're engaged in pipeline protest.
And the latest protest on the Red River came as another spill was reported on the Mississippi River headwaters, where Enbridge has continued to drill despite a temporary halt buffer zone issued by White Earth Nation. What's the latest on the construction of the pipeline and other actions?
Construction is 24 hours a day. Enbridge is working as fast as it possibly can. I'm guessing after police were harming Indigenous people using rubber bullets paid for by the Enbridge company, that there's probably even more of a push to get this done as quickly as possible before the Army Corps intervenes, if that's indeed what they choose to do. There is an ongoing call out to the Army Corps, to the Biden administration, to intervene before more people are hurt, before more frackouts happen at the Mississippi River headwaters, the place where the Mississippi River, one of the biggest river systems in the world, begins. There have been a number of spills just in that one location and several others along the 200 water bodies that are proposed to be impacted by Line 3, the 800 wetlands that this project wants to go through.
Tara, we just showed the images that you put out, just even of yourself with the rubber bullet welts on your arms. If you could describe why you're doing this. I mean, we're seeing progressives in Congress, they're fighting hard. You are putting your bodies on the line. And what message do you have for Washington now as they fight over this infrastructure bill, these two bills? What you're doing, what you want them to know about Minnesota, about the Gino Collective camp, and how you've been blockaded there by the police?
I began my own professional career in Washington, D.C., and understand a lot of how the dynamics of Capitol Hill work. I worked in various offices, including the White House, when I was out there. And it is so clear to me and to the many young people who are part of not just this movement, but movements across the globe, the Indigenous people who are leading struggle to protect the last beautiful sacred places, that it is simply not working fast enough. In the conversations and arguments that are very based in status quo, in this idea that we will continue on in the way that we have always done things, and that it is simply a matter of transitioning into another form of energy economy, that is not reflective of what is actually happening. We should understand that as the last time I spoke with you, there was an entire city that had been burned to the ground from wildfires that are directly related to climate crisis. The climate crisis is happening. And for myself, if it takes seeing Indigenous bodies being brutalized to understand what is really occurring in real time, what is happening to the people as we are defending these last places, that's what I'm willing to do. And that's what many, many others are willing to do. I was just one of many people who were hurt. I was put in solitary confinement. I was denied medical care after being hospitalized when I got brought in. We as human beings have to decide what we're going to do. And some of us are pushing as hard as we can with everything that we can.
Tara Housko, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Indigenous lawyer and activist, founder of the Gyanu Collective, Ojibwe from the Kochiching First Nations, speaking to us from Minnesota, where she was just recently arrested, hospitalized, put in solitary confinement, and now out, brutalized with police shooting rubber bullets at her. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for our video production fellowship and our digital fellowship here in our New York City studio. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dean Augusta, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tersena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astadu, John Hamilton. Special thanks. I'm Amy Goodwin Gonzalez.